The following recording by the LA Sound Posse is a compilation of a series of 8 short talks written, produced, and read for radio by Edwin L. Lang in October of 2005. This primer on democratic socialism is an expanded version of his printed pamphlet, You Don't Have to Be a Saint to Be a Socialist. Ed Lang is a longtime activist, socialist, civil libertarian, and lawyer. He was also a journalist, Navy officer, and overseas Peace Corps manager. Contact information and credits will be given at the end of the talk.
Radio, remember radio. We'd sit and close our eyes and use our imagination. Comedy, mystery, a fireside chat. Together we sat, listening nightly to our favorite show. Radio, why did you ever go? Oh, won't you please come back and entertain us? I long to turn the dial again.
This is Ed Lang with You Don't Have to Be a Saint to Be a Socialist, a basic series on democratic socialism. What is democratic socialism? What if the world were a place where everyone had the comfortable essentials of a full life, including satisfying work, housing, food, clothing, and health care, plus the opportunity to learn and develop into all she or he could be? A world where neither the environment nor people were unfairly exploited. Democratic socialism is the exciting, life-affirming idea for a world that works for everyone, a vision whose time can come now out of the world crisis of capitalism. Simply put, democratic socialism extends democracy from the political system to the economic system. A democratic political system is a system of government controlled by the people. Socialists want to extend that democratic control to the way goods and services are produced so that the people control the means of production. We want to change from a form where production is for profit, capitalism, to a form where production is for the comfortable and necessary use of all, in harmony with the earth, socialism.
What's wrong with a system where profit is the purpose of production?
A great many things. Look around you at the nature of work, the uncertainty of day-to-day life, the scramble to get by for millions of folks. People are getting ready for change. Capitalism as a system is inherently undemocratic, both internally and in its economic power over government and communications media. Capitalism as a system has no goal whatsoever other than capital accumulation, creating great wealth and poverty simultaneously. For example, to maximize profits, unemployment is necessary in order to weaken the bargaining power of working people seeking higher pay or better benefits and working conditions, because workers know that others are competing for their jobs. Unemployment creates insecurity and poverty and pits worker against worker, often along lines of race, ethnicity, or class, where those who are lower on the economic ladder or differ in some way are made to appear your competitors or willing to work for less. Even without unemployment, the profit system results in absurd differences in wealth, where a few at the top have more than they can ever use, and enormous numbers of people are left with not enough or in poverty. George Monbiot, M-O-N-B-I-O-T, points out that the combined incomes of the least well-off one-half of the world's people, over 3 billion folks, is less than the total wealth of the world's richest 500 people. At the same time, capitalism's race for profits requires enormous expenditures for advertising paid for by the consumer, with its manipulation of our wants and fears, and the downplaying of our critical ability, which ability is crucial in a democracy, since all we need to do is respond at our primitive level to this materialistic commodification of life. Maximizing profits results in exploitation of workers, the environment, and the consumer. Capitalists can make more money for themselves if they pay their workers as little as they can get by with. The same if they use up the environment rather than respect and husband it. Consumers forget that maximizing profit is the ultimate source of injury to people caused by many things, such as unsafe drugs and insecticides knowingly promoted to millions. Remember Vioxx and DDT? And automobiles that were unsafe across the board. Remember Nader's book, Unsafe at Any Speed, that proved it?
What about cheaper goods? They say that capitalism is based on competition so that prices are controlled by the market. Capitalists tell us that producing more cheaply and defeating competitors is good for the consumer.
These are two of the utopian ideas of capitalism. In practice, many markets have no real competition, and a huge part of the world's poorer population is left out of the market altogether. The classic repeated statement by petroleum spokespersons in the run-up of gasoline prices was, "We'd rather sell less gas, but at higher prices, than more gas at lower prices." In other words, squeeze the consumer to pay more or go without. Save the product to save and sell at higher profits later, and the public be damned. Further, producing more cheaply may give impoverished lives to workers, but often does not result in lower prices and only increases profits. The saving may not be passed on to consumers or workers. But the real goal of capitalist competition is to dominate or monopolize the market so that competition disappears and prices can then be set high or market share be increased. Then, when market control expands far enough, prices can be expected to be raised as much as the market will bear. Put another way, the final purpose of competition in capitalism is to end or reduce competition. And we must remember that defeating competitors often results in the defeated competitors losing their money and their workers losing their jobs or being squeezed to accept less pay and benefits so as to make it easier for the boss to compete. A system based on losing money or defeating the ability to earn a living is a wasteful system harmful to people. This wasteful and destructive, necessary nature of capitalism is what Albert Einstein, who most people don't know was a socialist, called economic anarchy. He described capitalism's monopolistic nature as, quote, an oligarchy of private capital, the enormous power of which cannot be effectively checked even by a democratically organized political society, close quote. See his article, Why Socialism, in the Independent Socialist Magazine Monthly Review, May 1949. And for a brilliant summary of Socialism for the 21st Century, see Monthly Review for July-August 2005, Volume 57, Number 3, on the web at monthlyreview.org.
So, what do you mean by a socialist form where production is for use and not for profit?
Socialists will not settle for a less than a system where fundamental human needs of all are fully met. Food, housing, health care, lifelong learning, and the opportunity to become the person you can be. People will decide democratically what things and services they really need and want. Not wants and wishes created by advertising and capitalist culture. This is what we mean by production for human use. These things and services will be produced and performed in workplaces where workers are treated and paid fairly and make the decisions to assure good working conditions, safety, health, retirement, etc. This kind of mutually supportive treatment and participation is the main idea of extending democracy to the workplace. Quoting Engels, Rosa Luxemburg said, "The choice for humanity is socialism or barbarism."
How do you know this will work to meet society's needs as democratically decided upon?
Because society as a whole will have decided to do things this way. And from workers' viewpoint, people want to have the secure, participatory kind of life where they engage in satisfying work in safe, rewarding conditions, rather than being at risk for the dangers and exploitation in a capitalist system.
Well, I also mean, how do you know this will work to actually produce the goods and services really needed and wanted?
Decentralized democratic decision-making by the people as a whole will constantly monitor and change the production process to be sure it is performing to meet requirements. Here, democracy is absolutely indispensable. When democratic control is lacking, an anti-capitalist system of any type usually reverts to capitalism and fascism, as happened in the so-called communist Soviet Union and China, who are now beset with new ruling classes and grotesque forms of capitalism. Neither revolution arose from democratic traditions, and democratic socialists certainly do not take them as models. In China, Mao hoped the mid-course cultural revolution, with terrible excesses, would establish democratic control by the workers and peasants. But it failed, and today China is slipping into fascism.
But can we afford to treat all of us fairly?
Absolutely. First, the enormous resources, technology, and production capabilities of today can easily generate a fair standard of living for all, especially if the enormous profits going to the very top capitalists under the present system are no longer a burden. Second, production requirements will be smaller and greener than in the wasteful, consumerist, debt-producing capitalist system we now have, where production must constantly expand in a cancerous way or die. As it expands without fair treatment of working people, there is overproduction, but not enough people with enough money to consume it, creating want and poverty. A major example of wasteful capitalism is the enormous war machine, which sucks up national wealth in welfare for arms makers. This makes crazy sense for a capitalist system that must seek to project political power militarily, that is, kill people, to dominate the rest of the world in order to control markets and resources to accumulate great wealth. Remember, capital accumulation is the only systemic purpose of capitalism, and it uses coercion and force whenever it can get away with it. Capitalist militarism makes no sense for socialists, who do not depend on expansion and accumulation of great wealth, because production is only for actual human needs. What if these enormous war machine resources and workers were put to work instead in meeting social needs, building housing, and so forth? Putting aside necessary international correctives by the world's nations collectively, socialists believe in letting other nations be independent and mutually meet needs by fair trade with us, not so-called free trade, which is imperialist and exploitive capitalism.
You mentioned needing decentralized democratic decision-making, but how can overall needs be met if each locality is making its own decisions independently?
A federal system with democratically chosen representatives may be the best way to ensure that we don't work at cross purposes or selfishly, but have a big picture constantly in mind. Those representatives would be charged with carrying out corrections to make the whole society benefit.
So, is this central planning?
Mixed with multiple local planning, yes. But remember, any nation has economic planning. It is only a matter of who does the planning, how well, and in whose interests. Capitalists do a lot of selfish short-term planning to maximize their own immediate profits, often at the expense of the society as a whole, such as by plundering and despoiling resources. These real social costs are ignored and passed on to the rest of society. Long-term planning for the whole society may have to emphasize education, energy, probably alternative energy, and infrastructure, such as mass and local transit, and it'll pay off in the long term.
You said socialism aims to provide satisfying work in safe, rewarding conditions. Not all work is like that.
You're right. People might decide that some dull, alienating work would be shared around or evaluated to see if that service or product were really needed or if there's another way to do it. Brute efficiency can be traded off for a method of doing things in a humane way. And if workers are hurt on the job, they would not need to fear they could not afford treatment or would be abandoned by society.
What do you mean by alienating work?
Sacrificing the workers' intelligence, creativity, and social involvement for machine-like efficiency. Alienation means cut off from. Marx pointed out that under capitalism, workers generally are cut off in four respects. One, they are alienated from their productive activity, from meaningful participation in decisions about what they do or how to do it, how fast, and so forth. Two, they are alienated from the product of that activity, having no control over what is made or what happens to it. Three, they are alienated from other human beings, isolated from each other, with competition replacing most forms of cooperation. Four, they are alienated from their potential, individually and in a shared community. It is exactly these four failures that socialism is dedicated to erasing.
I don't understand why you say socialist production is not for profit. Don't the social benefits, etc., that you want require profits?
There has to be enough paid in from consumers, taxpayers, overall, to support the costs of production and provision of services. In that sense, of course, there is profit. But the socialist method is to produce for use, that is, for reasonable, necessary wants and comfort, and any profits would go back to replenish worn-out equipment, etc., and to the people in whatever fair manner they democratically determined. The important difference is that the capitalist system is built on sucking out private profits at whatever cost to the environment, wages, etc., in order to give great wealth to a few. A socialist system starts from the principle that people's needs and development, in harmony with the environment, are always the primary goal, and that profit must always serve that alone.
Well, what do you mean by people's needs and development?
Socialism will strive to provide the conditions and opportunity for each person to reach his or her full potential as a human being in all respects. This is the great fundamental vision and goal and cannot be overemphasized. Full individuality of each. Not individualism, which instead would seek to defeat others to aggrandize the self. Socialist society is based on cooperation and respect for others, not competition in the sense of defeating others. Ample opportunity for people to excel will be available in every field and not be limited to an elite.
But some people say socialism has failed.
Real socialism has never been tried, or a start has been attempted briefly in places like Chile in the early 1970s and overthrown by the capitalists and armed forces, abetted by the United States government.
What is this S word anyway?
Socialism is not state capitalism, where a bureaucrat signs your paycheck instead of a private owner, but where the necessities of capitalism and its methods and limitations still control. Socialism is not a private ownership, capitalist welfare state with all those same problems. The United States was forced by the Great Depression of the 1930s to set up some social security, housing, unemployment protections, and the like. But this never went far enough, and the half-built welfare state has been systematically destroyed in the last decades. More on this in a minute when I talk about social democracy. But has socialism failed? The answer is no. Real socialism, as I have described it, has never been tried. Or you could say that a start has been attempted in places like Chile, where a socialist, Salvador Allende, was elected president in the early 1970s, fair and square, in a free and democratic election. His democratically elected government was overthrown by the capitalists and the armed forces, abetted by the United States government. But here we get into important distinctions and into careful labeling. For example, an accurate description of the former Soviet Union may be bureaucratic centralism, state capitalism, capitalism without capitalists, or something else. But it was never socialist, except perhaps at the start, in the great tradition of left, humanist, radical democratic thinking. A lot has been written about this, but it's a rather pointless sidetrack. The real point is that we can build a society that has the values and forms I have described previously, one that is democratic and not capitalist.
So what is the essential nature of socialism?
The essence of socialism is fully democratic control of the means of production by the people to produce the comfortable essentials of a full life for all, not for profit, but for human use. The historic name for such a society is socialist. Let me repeat, fully democratic control by the people of the means of production and the performance of services to provide the comfortable needs and security of a full, healthy life for everybody. Not just to make profits, but always for genuine needs and use. Not for war, not to get rich, not for manipulated or contrived wants, not by defeating or exploiting others, and not by plundering resources and damaging the environment. You know, capitalists have tried to make socialism a dirty word by attaching it to all manner of other things in capitalist society. Regulation of industry, limits on land use, the welfare state, taxes, or even any attempt to make the government responsive to the needs of ordinary people. These may all be good things, but in a capitalist society, they are reformist only. Capitalism cannot be reformed because the system itself is the problem. Its undemocratic nature, its inevitable drive to maximize profits and accumulate at everybody else's expense, its need for unemployment, racism, expansion, war, plunder of resources, monopolization, etc.
But the Soviet Union and others used the term socialist.
They sure did. However, you simply can't have socialism without democracy and civil liberties. This is emphasized by the term democratic socialism, but that's really redundant. The kind of society I am advancing has nothing to do with the authoritarian states who hijack the name for demagogic purposes. What I have described earlier as socialism obviously cannot exist without a democratic form, and we can have such a society. It is a fallacy to say that every country's experience will be like a certain other country's just because they used a similar label to describe themselves.
But aren't there socialist countries like Sweden and Cuba?
The accurate term for Sweden is social democracy, a capitalist, mixed economy, welfare state, where high taxes support social benefits. Most of the productive capacity in Sweden has always been in private ownership. You don't get socialism by simple tax and spend on social benefits, although that certainly has helped provide necessities for people in Sweden and Norway, for example. Norway has been able to provide a social safety net because of large oil resources now being depleted. The alienation of workers from their productive activity, from the product of that activity, from each other, and from their potential in a shared community, all this remains in a mixed economy, social democracy, such as Sweden, whose welfare, embedded in capitalist values, has been eroding under international economic pressures. You know, U.S. imperialist capitalist interests were not threatened by Sweden and Norway, but the U.S. government has not allowed social democrats in many other places seen as fair game for plunder, such as the Dominican Republic, Juan Bosch and Camaño y Daño, in Guatemala, Arbenz, etc., etc. Of course, they always called them communists in order to discredit their efforts, but that is simply not true. These same capitalist interests in the U.S. have already destroyed the attempt at a welfare state here and certainly will not permit going further with a full old-style European social democracy here. These are being destroyed in Europe itself. Look at Germany and France today. In Germany, massive unemployment has reached levels near those before World War II for the first time. So if you want a fair social system, why not make the fight for socialism instead of a losing fight for a stingy, decaying capitalism that is sliding toward a police state and bankruptcy, and won't even be able to sustain itself after the peak in energy supply, wars, global warming, and a depleted citizenry.
What about Cuba?
Cuba is an undemocratic or partly democratic anti-capitalist state, perhaps becoming capitalist, with amazing health and education benefits for its repressed people. But as you can see, it cannot be described as socialist under the analysis I have given. For decades, Cuba has been under increasing U.S. attack, especially by Bush the Lesser. But under international law, the U.S. has absolutely no right to interfere with the affairs of other countries, nor they with ours.
Well, we hear the word socialist a lot in the names of political parties around the world.
Too often, political parties around the world that have the word socialist in their names do not have socialist programs. And if in power, merely administer capitalism, as in some countries in Europe. They are trading on the enormous appeal and popular identification made by invoking the liberating, egalitarian tradition that working people understand and want. How many political parties are there with capitalist in their name? And Hitler's National Socialism, the Nazis, of course, had nothing to do with socialism and a whole lot to do with capitalism.
Well, since socialism has all these other connotations, why not use another term?
Fine, how about economic democracy? But even that term is being used in a different way now. The point is that the whole humanist, democratic, anti-capitalist, intellectual history uses the term socialism. And that is the one I prefer because it locates us more accurately and historically. But as soon as you call it economic democracy or goodism or anything else, people will say, as they should, hey, that's really socialism, isn't it? Are you trying to fool me? So let's not.
How does the term communist fit in with the rest of left political thinking?
All over the lot. One meaning is a future stage of egalitarian cooperative society, not unlike socialism, perhaps like the early Christians or present-day convents, but with a secular democratic form. Historically, communists sometimes opposed socialists, and of course, communist is used by some as an all-purpose swear word because of its association with authoritarian countries like the Stalinist Soviet Union and China. Like democracy and socialism, it has a wide range of meanings. It has to be specifically nailed down in each context in order to know which meaning is intended. For example, democratic socialists vigorously reject elitist so-called vanguard communist parties, who say their leaders have the truth and must dominate everybody else, who recruit young men for violence, and who hark back to wanting a dictatorship of the proletariat. We all know what finally resulted from Maoist communism in China, an elitist, fascist capitalism, and an oppressed working class with few rights. Democratic socialists firmly reject authoritarian solutions and instead work toward a radically new revolutionary society, arising democratically from building a mass movement of the people, cherishing free speech and civil liberties as protections against leadership and government. Sadly, sometimes there are good reasons why the left is split. Perhaps we'll march in the same demonstrations against injustice, but we won't merge with authoritarian groups.
Where do the anarchists fit into all this?
In the everyday sense, of course, anarchy means lawless, out of control. But in the political sense, it refers to a society of voluntary cooperation. Anarchism has an important social change history and several strands, some related to socialism. Anarchism is popular now with many young people. I wonder if some of the appeal arises from their feeling overwhelmed with the tangled, failing politics of today and the obvious mess everything is in, and from its emphasis on a perhaps romantic kind of individualism and freedom from social responsibility, and also arises from the excitement and simplicity of taking direct action. Anarchism's anti-government tradition appeals to libertarians of the left, but also for different goals to laissez-faire capitalists and to libertarians of the right. Government power often is so abusive and pervasive now that it feeds this anarchist trend. Instead, we need a system that is truly democratic to control government, such as in a radically democratic, decentralized socialist society.
Earlier, you mentioned socialists being in, quote, the great tradition of left humanist radical democratic thinking, unquote. And you say you want a radically new society. My mother told me not to be a radical.
Well, we use the term in its strict dictionary sense, to go to the root, like 2 is the square root of 4. This is an essential idea for socialism. We don't want to just make capitalism less bad, as liberals want, because we realize that the system itself is the problem. Liberals are not radicals. For example, a capitalist welfare state, where high taxes support a large social welfare program, still presents the four kinds of unacceptable alienation of human beings that I referred to earlier. And the capitalist system requires that natural resources be used heavily, that labor be squeezed and weak, that consumers buy more and more high-profit items out of needs manufactured by advertising, etc., all requirements that come from the essential nature of capitalism. Remember, capitalism's goal is not the satisfaction of human needs. As a system, it has only one goal, maximizing profits and accumulation of wealth at the expense of everything and everybody else. My friends who are liberals whack away at capitalism's abuses, but capital will never willingly give up enough profits to provide a full life for everyone. Nor can it change its essentially destructive and exploitive nature.
Do all socialists agree with what you were saying?
Oh, no. I'm trying to present a current understanding of democratic socialism. There are many opinions. This gets confusing because, are you ready? Sometimes good people and organizations call themselves democratic socialists when I think of their views as merely social democratic or liberal. For example, they look to the capitalist political parties. I certainly do not. The Democratic Party now is where social movements go to die. Though there are exceptions, the party is bought and paid for by wealth, as is the Republican Party. In Gore Vidal's famous phrase, "In America we have one political party with two right wings," or in Greg Palast's title, "The best democracy money can buy." This is inevitable in an economic system devoted to buying, that is, shaping and manipulating public consent, requiring enormous campaign media funds to run for office. With socialism, the means of production and wealth will be held by the people, so wealth will not be able to buy elections. Campaigns will be publicly funded and utilize the airwaves free, as they were originally intended to be used for, quote, "the public interest, convenience, and necessity," close quote, not to make profits for the capitalists.
What's a neoliberal?
No relation. The word picks up on the term liberalism as used decades ago when laissez-faire capitalism was breaking all restraints and expanding in a self-seeking dominant way. Today, neoliberals are the same, and typically seek to dominate by investment and trade penetration and privatization of essentials overseas at the expense of social programs and workers.
You locate socialism in the humanist tradition. I'm religious.
Great. There is no conflict. In fact, democratic socialism is a natural method to install fairness and love as the very basis for society. Socialists advance the humanist emphasis on each individual's dignity, worth, and capacity for actualization. Marx said that people should struggle against harmful social conditions and not just give up and use religion to hope for a better life after death. He also said that religion was a haven in a heartless world. A century and a half later, it is even more of a heartless capitalist world. Of course, religious hierarchies have often allied themselves with wealth and privilege or injustice. And when that happens, socialists will oppose those policies. And as strong civil libertarians, we will likewise oppose attacks on religious freedom for all. the core values of the great religions can most easily find expression in democratic socialism because of its insistence on individual worth and providing the conditions for each person to get past economic limitation in a way that demeans and exploits no one and that opens the door to whatever spiritual life that person chooses. The same goes for most New Age thinking, feminism, and populism, as each gets around to seeking the socioeconomic framework to maximize, practice, and develop their values. Here it is. Personal development alone is not enough. We walk on two legs, the personal, which won't change the social framework, and the political, to secure a socioeconomic system that can carry out and protect those personal values for all. Patriarchal capitalism exploits and discriminates against women. So important feminist analysis is embedded in socialism, as is anti-racism, because of our insistence that past wrongs must be righted and that all receive fair treatment. Fighting pervasive racism is now a priority. And the populist battle against the hydra-headed monster of corporate domination opens the door for populists to next address the underlying support system of capitalist exploitation itself.
I like the program of the Green Party.
So do I. It has carried forward the defense of the environment which socialism supports, and it has criticized big corporations. I hope Greens will come to grips with the systemic character of capitalism's destructiveness. When they do, their program will resemble that of democratic socialists.
Well, is it legal to be a socialist? And how do we get to a socialist society?
Yes, it certainly is legal to be a socialist in any democracy. And to get there, first, people have to know about socialism and the nature of capitalism. Socialism needs to get on the political menu. This is crucial and is what this series is about. Earlier, I talked about the inherent flaws of capitalism and its failure. When people actually know what we are suggesting, are rid of their misconceptions, and are not tied into uncritical acceptance of capitalism, then most people will realize that socialism is what they need and want, because it gives them assurance of not only all the basics for a good life, but humane and satisfying work and benign relations with others and with nature, together with the circumstances to develop all sides of their potential. With this understanding, change is inevitable, and events will take their course. I hope and believe it will be in a democratic way and in a legal framework that continues the protections against the state found in the Bill of Rights, with a constitution that reflects the core ideas and protections we have been talking about, and that retains the best of our present constitution.
Well, I understand that the very purpose and plan of the society will be to provide these things, production for use. But what will be different in everyday life?
The nature of work and social relations. I talked earlier about democratically determining desired production needs and methods to create satisfying work in safe, rewarding conditions, cooperatively in a shared community. Here's an example. The other day I went into a name brand pizza parlor that had been recommended to me. Men with brown skins were working at a furious clip to prepare and serve the pizzas. I looked at the menu. Typical. Too much obesity-producing food for more money than you prefer to spend. like my refrigerator at home, large portions I had had to buy that will half go to waste. The system must maximize profits by selling more, particularly of appealing but unhealthy food, and charging more. I only wanted a small pizza. There wasn't any such thing on the menu, and they didn't sell by the slice. Should I go home and eat leftovers? Finally, I saw it in small print, child's size pizza. I was saved. Fending off their request for me to order some kind of overpriced flavored sugar water, I ordered. Even though I was not a child, they accepted the order. It was delicious. I left a tip figured on the price of an adult pizza. So, as the song says, imagine. Come the revolution, we will have pizza. Perhaps we will have decided to use locally produced ingredients, maybe even organic. Maybe we will have had to after the fossil fuel energy decline makes chemicals scarce and transportation costly. Our using local ingredients will support local growers, our friends and neighbors. Ingredients may be a bit different, and they will be fresh and nutritious. Less sugar-loaded food and less processed food will make us healthier. We won't have to overeat to support a capitalist economy. I can order a small size or a couple slices. Less waste makes it easier to have what we actually want and saves money and ingredients. The pizza will be delicious. Demand for flavored sugar waters will have fallen off, what with advertising for it having disappeared. Because quality of life for everyone is now more important than rushing to maximize profit, service will be less frantic, and we will have an extra minute or two to chat with the person next to us while we wait. So, life is less stressful for the pizza workers, who will not have to be those who have brown skins and be forced to work for less, since we will all be paid fairly and be committed to sharing resources to provide everybody with pleasant housing, good food, clothing, health care, emphasizing prevention, and broad education. Maybe the price of the pizza will be less. We won't be paying in for expensive salaries at the top or for advertising, since demand does not have to be generated through advertising. This is because the local community will have already decided we want to have pizza and will share the resources to do it. Speaking of advertising, display advertising as we knew it will have disappeared and has morphed into that new main tool of socialist commerce, the classified advertising sections. If you decide you need something, based on your own wishes, and not as being manipulated to buy, that's where you look, the classifieds. The old socialist joke by now is that when the means of production were socialized, first priorities for socialization were given to all the companies that had had full-page advertising. But maybe the price of the pizza will be more. Prices and production needs will be set democratically by producers and consumers to fit with overall social goals. It may be that pizza eaters will pay more so that we can all have better education, for example. Or maybe the pizza will cost more for a while to save for a new oven, something like that.
You were saying that it is essential that people know about socialism and the nature of capitalism as the first step to a socialist society. Will the corporate news entertainment media advance this understanding?
Not for the most part. The many irrationalities of capitalism as a system are simply invisible to them. For example, there is tremendous social and environmental expenditure to rush to plant huge amounts of wine grapes and then, experiencing loss of income and jobs, tear out much of the vines a few years later, as happened recently in California. The way this uncontrollable free market system, example is reported, is like a weather report on yesterday's thunder shower. Yesterday's rainfall was a tenth of an inch. Acreage of wine grapes is big reduced as prices fall. Rather than giving us an understanding of the wine glut caper as preventable through societal planning, or explaining the human and dollar costs, the lost water and agricultural resources, etc., as part of a crazy system we don't need to have. So we are constantly miseducated by the polluted stream media. As cigarettes are a nicotine delivery system, infotainment is a capitalist advertising delivery system. The content must not be unacceptable to business. General Motors spends $10 million a year on advertising. Recently, when the Los Angeles Times had a critical news piece on GM, it withdrew its advertising. But some corporate media will do anything for circulation or viewers. They even present ideas occasionally that are counter to them if they think they can sell products by doing so. Perhaps a radical variation of public journalism is a step in the right direction. This idea, as begun, does not have a radical political orientation, but approaches journalism in a different fashion that seeks to make decision-making more democratic and informed, to engage communities in public life, to generate questions about what alternatives exist, what would people like politicians to be discussing, what public political options exist, and what values underlie each choice. There may be less resistance by the corporate media, at least at the start, and it brings people into involvement in their communities and public life, which is what radical democracy is about, and which is necessary for socialism to happen. However, do not expect corporate journalism to be open to radical ideas in general, or even to steer thinking in a way that is not self-seeking. That would be against its nature.
Are there steps to take right now? In the immortal words, what is to be done?
We need a movement. Our main opportunity is to work together apart from what I call the polluted stream media, both because we will not receive a fair shake there, and because this approach creates a genuine movement independent of the corporate world. The internet will be a lot of help. You know, it's easy for activists to get fragmented by fighting for single issues of social justice and responding to each new outrage. Immediate demands on the system are necessary, but they do not build a cohesive radical movement by themselves. For example, we hear about the fight to preserve organic agriculture standards, but big capitalist producers fight to weaken them, to maximize profits. So it goes back to the system. There is always talk of organizing around the anti-war movement, etc., but rarely does this result in starting a broad movement on a range of issues with an overall radical orientation. Many people who may not think of themselves as leftists now do share with us a number of values about fairness, broad and real family values, a moral life, government accountable only to wealth, working conditions, job and retirement security, material excess, cooperation, the environment, health care, and a secure and enjoyable life. We need to identify these and plan how to reach each other in building a radical movement. The right wing spent years and millions of dollars from wealthy sources on think tanks and grassroots political organizing to get where it is today. We won't have those millions of dollars. But better still, we can form local small-scale groups to learn about each other's lives and to teach and help each other. We can link with the hip-hop generation. We can restore the community values that were suppressed when the capitalist constitution was rammed down the American people's throats over 200 years ago. Jerry Freesia, in his book Toward an American Revolution, Exposing the Constitution and Other Illusions, South End Press, 1988, described that time. Quote, common people seemed willing to take care of one another. Together they had a greater appreciation of their common interests. Individual needs were understood in part as community needs. These sets of needs and values were much different from the market-oriented approach to life pressed by the most important economic groups within coastal towns, the merchants, shopkeepers, lawyers, bankers, speculators, and commercial farmers, the class out of which the framers of the Constitution emerged. Close quote. Non-reformist reforms can be begun now to build towards socialism. These are reforms that do not simply make capitalism work a little better for the downtrodden, as liberals often do, but that make changes in social structures and new organizations that will be like ones we can use in a socialist society, such as the groups for mutual aid and networks independent of the capitalist framework just mentioned. Building the new within the shell of the old, but not depending on capitalist values, methods, and infrastructure. There is a remarkable trend of the environmentalist sustainability folks now, anticipating the upheaval that will occur from the slide down from the peak availability of fossil fuels. They are bringing to bear plans to localize housing, transport, and food production, and to utilize permaculture for super efficient and self-sustaining organic agriculture. Socialists can learn from them and help prepare for the time when U.S. capitalism collapses, whether from debt, deficit, dollar failure, global warming, or energy depletion. Then small-scale production, cooperation, and intentional communities will survive. Simpler living will be good living. We don't need the useless goods and wants that capitalism sells us at the price of social injustice and costly military imperialism. We can produce for use and each other and the good life.
What about violence?
I am a revolutionary, but totally against violence. It won't work, and if it did, the lesson of history is that the means become the ends, as it has in China, which is now capitalist and fascist. The result would not be democratic, and it would probably be at least as bad as what we have now. This is not the 1960s. Now the technology and techniques of social control are Orwellian. We must educate ourselves and organize in a nonviolent mass movement of millions of people. Mass solidarity and the immense power of the people will then be clear, as more and more people, failed by capitalism, come over to our side. Non-reformist reforms will be everywhere. Much of the new will have been built within the shell of old, failing capitalism. As capitalism crashes, it will have neither the means nor the will to prevent a just society from emerging at last to take control of the means of production for the benefit of all.
Will big capitalists hold still for socialism to happen?
What do you think? Maybe they will receive long-term bonds in exchange. However, Even former capitalists will actually be better off with socialism unless they are simply greedy or must have power over others.
But won't big capital and the state try to suppress socialists?
They already do, in the sense that they define the acceptable frame of discourse by the pervasive self-censorship of ideas in the corporate media, by which I mean their exclusion of radical left ideas and analysis in political discussion and the presentation of news. I include most of public radio TV in this. Down the road, when there is a real socialist movement, they can be expected to try suppression overtly. Government usually reflects and acts for the dominant economic power. If this happens, socialist solidarity and momentum will come into play. People will have a chance to support each other and act in solidarity across racial, ethnic, working class, and middle class lines to create forms of mutual support. With a mass movement, the polarity soon will change. After all, the premises of capitalism are already starting to collapse. It's irrationally necessary plunder of the environment, fossil fuels, and the lives of millions of people. For example, 20% of American children live below the poverty line today. What do they owe capitalism?
You said across middle class lines, too.
Certainly. You can't have a fundamental democratic change without much of the middle class, part of which, in turn, is now falling into the lower class, as American wealth is carried to the top. The core problems I have been discussing apply to the middle class too, even if some of them are better off financially. For example, the values of capitalism, competition, maximizing profits, etc., and the way work is now organized and must be carried out, are often destructive of a moral life, family life, and good mental health. This applies to all.
But who is in the middle class?
Originally, the term referred to the emerging capitalist class under the feudal system. Now it seems to be merely an amorphous middle layer of income. If a worker is one who must sell her or his labor power to someone else for wages or salary, the blue working class collar or white middle class collar matters little. A capitalist, on the other hand, lives off ownership of the means of production.
Well, what about little capitalists in a socialist society?
Some socialists talk about extending democratic control only to the commanding heights of the economy, to socialize big business, bring into democratic production, not merely to nationalize it, capitalism without private capitalists. But isn't it still exploitive of labor, etc., and alienating for employees to work for a middle-sized company based on the profit system? Small businesses, mom-and-pop businesses that do not make money off capital or someone else's labor, exploit little except perhaps themselves by long hours and hard work.
So socialism would not take my stuff?
Of course not. Commanding heights aside, socialism comes from producing in a humane, green way for the benefit of each other.
What about retired people who live off productive property?
This is practically everybody who is retired, but who don't keep all their money under the mattress. Like me, they are involuntary capitalists to that extent. Since their only other choice is to get their money out, if they can, and watch it get eaten up by inflation, which in a decade typically rips them off by at least 30%, thus keeping them prisoners in capitalism's gambling house or risk going broke before they die. Inflation is an irrationality embedded in capitalism's money system. Money increasing faster than productivity, demand exceeding supply, the borrower economy, etc. But with socialism, the people can control the economy so that these capitalist elements are avoided within that country. The point is for us retired people not to be embarrassed by being involuntary capitalists to the extent of survival while capitalism lasts, any more than a worker need be embarrassed by having to work for a capitalist now. It's a challenge to both be in and to try to stand outside the system. With socialism, the welfare of the retired would have to be guaranteed in a transitional phase to social ownership of the means of production, and of course, when that was complete, their welfare would be amply provided along with everyone else's.
Why aren't more people socialists?
Several reasons. The main one is that people don't know about it or are miseducated about it. Since the corporate media and schools mostly miseducate because they always reflect the going system. This is by far the most important reason. In practical terms, a movement has been slow to develop because we are not used to thinking of movement building as something we can do or feel comfortable about, because it is a step away from immediacy. We all want to do something now about the things we really care about. The political is personal. People do political things for ultimately personal reasons that present themselves at the feeling level. So choosing to work for fundamental change later on is a challenge. It will succeed when our values and social conditions get real for us. But there are several thinking obstacles that we simply and unnecessarily impose on ourselves. Michael Lerner has a phrase for it, surplus powerlessness. In spite of great successes by the left over the years, we have a bad habit of playing down those successes and underestimating our power. Sometimes we overlook the systemic reasons for our own economic problems and secretly blame ourselves if we're not rich and famous, or even if we're unemployed. The coin of capitalism reads on one side, "I got mine." But it is the other side of that coin that enslaves us. "I can get mine." That false belief is that in the order of things, we deserve what we got. The fallout from the very effective false teaching of utopian capitalism that everybody can be a millionaire or even have a decent job if he or she truly deserves it. Another thinking obstacle is that fundamental change seems impossible. Millions of people see the flaws, cruelties, and injustices of capitalism. But they may not have thought about this in a systematic way and may fear that the problem is too big to do anything about. Here, the quote from Margaret Mead is still valid. "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." There are a great many people who do understand the capitalist roots of our problems. I meet them all the time. Many are closet socialists. They are now discouraged about making fundamental social change. They will come forward when the momentum builds. Remember the Vietnam War. Opponents were a seeming small minority. Opposition built momentum. And then one unmarked day, the polarity changed. And the rest is history. Finally, cognitive dissonance and denial are major thinking obstacles. For example, it's hard to both be in the capitalist system and try to stand critically outside it. As mentally healthy human beings, we want to feel good about our job, our company, etc. It is unpleasant to have to realize that the system is sick and perhaps making our lives fail.
What do you mean by cognitive dissonance?
Cognition is another word for knowing. Cognition consists of our frameworks for understanding the world as formed by our education and experience. We do not make sense of life raw. We understand it by these frameworks built on our past experience and belief. For example, every day we learn, uncritically, how the capitalist world works, even if we don't know what capitalism is. This is the default setting, the conventional wisdom, the mainstream, the way the world is. For instance, we hear the capitalist newscast over public radio report that things are good because unemployment has not gone down, so the stock market is up because business costs will not be up from increased worker demands. We are not told that this, more working people out of work, can be bad for working people. When we then see that this world doesn't provide for the humane values we have been discussing, and that a socialist framework can, two ways of understanding now conflict. If one is true, the other can't be. But we have put our eggs in the present capitalist basket. We are conditioned to that implicit world, feel some comfort in it, and make sense of things that way. The conflict shakes up our way of making sense of everyday life. This conflict is like two musical notes that clash, are dissonant. We are stuck between them. Because socialism threatens these old unexamined assumptions, patterns, and assurances, including negative assurances, we experience cognitive dissonance. One result can be to lapse into denial, to avoid the discomfort of having to accept our new understanding and its implications. We risk realizing that capitalism as a system has already failed as far as our lives are concerned.
And what are negative assurances?
For instance, rents are high, but that's the way the world is. With the implicit conclusion, negative assurance, that there's really nothing that can be done. It isn't even discussed, except in liberal terms such as a very long shot at a possible rent control law if the problem becomes extreme. With socialism, the starting point would be to provide housing for all.
Are people good enough to become socialists?
Being good or perfectible, etc., has nothing to do with it. If ordinary people realize what capitalism really does and learn what democratic socialism can do, many will want to try it. People don't have to be intrinsically good. Democratic forms will correct their mistakes and excesses. However, for capitalism to function, it must encourage personality and behavior that are aggressive, acquisitive, manipulative, and selfish. I call this bad. But a system based on real human values will reinforce humane behavior. I call this good.
You know, I knew somebody who didn't have much, but always took strangers into his home, freely shared everything he had, and was very open and generous. Somebody said he was a real socialist.
Sounds more like a saint to me. I think that's fine, but you don't have to be a saint to be a socialist, nor do you have to live in a hovel and give everything away. The virtues and satisfactions, and perhaps even the planetary necessity of simple living aside, why not have a swimming pool if you can afford it? Although it would be cheaper and maybe even more fun to share one. Even wealthy people can be socialists if they work toward the kind of society we are talking about. But they would be hypocritical if they choose to exploit people at the same time.
Radio, why did you ever go? Oh, won't you please come back and entertain us?
This primer on democratic socialism is an expanded version of my printed pamphlet, You Don't Have to Be a Saint to Be a Socialist. Send mail to Ed Lang, P.O. Box 186, Summerland, California, 93067. Email Ed Lang, E-D-L-A-I-N-G, at silcom, S-I-L-C-O-M.com. For a free hard copy of my You Don't Have to Be a Saint to Be a Socialist pamphlet, upon which these audio programs were based, email me at Ed Lang, that's E-D-L-A-I-N-G, all one word, at cellcom, S-I-L-C-O-M, .com. Or comment to that email. Make the revolution. Until next time.
Radio, why did you ever go? Oh, won't you please come back and entertain us?
Questions voiced by Norma Kutzer. Recordist was Nick Green of The Away Team, Isla Vista, California. The Away Team at Cox.net. Music by Wooden Nickel Jazz Band. The tune Radio by Bob Marcus. Vocalist Brady McKay. Copyright 2005 Edwin L. Lang. All rights reserved. No restrictions on unedited reproduction. If distributed free or at a charge not exceeding the cost of reproduction.
Remember radio, we'd sit and close our eyes and use our imagination. Comedy, mystery, a fireside chat. Together we sat, listening nightly to our favorite show. Radio, why did you ever go? Oh, won't you please come back and entertain us? I long to turn the dial again, to hear the best and smile again. Radio, I miss you so.
You have been listening to a compilation of an available 8-part radio series on democratic socialism done by Edwin L. Lang. It was prepared by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.